As I said, I'd like to spend the next four times that I'm going to be teaching here, second and fourth Sundays in April and May, focusing on this set of teachings of the Buddha on how to live together in spiritual community. And to begin that, I would like to make reference to the Dharma wheel, the Dharma chakra that we have here on the altar this evening. It's a depiction of the Eightfold Path, which is the teachings of the Buddha on how one becomes free of suffering, how we learn to cease causing harm to, suffering for ourselves and others, okay? And begin to replace those kinds of behaviors with those that bring peace and that bring a certain amount of selfless joy, that are born of compassion, okay, that help make the world a better place when we're out there. All of this, of course, comes from within, right? One of the interesting features of the Dharma wheel, these eight spokes, each of them just depicting an aspect, okay? There's an inner aspect and an outer aspect, you know, to the wheel. The very earliest depictions of the Dharma wheel, like this one here, the hub is empty, right? And so, in that understanding, all that we're able to do in the realm of living the Eightfold Path, okay, proceeds from that emptiness within, okay? Which is to say, the knowledge of living from the perspective of absence of self, okay, and being able to be at ease with, you know, allowing the mind to become so calm that it falls into this space of absence of self, is one that, when possible, becomes momentarily self-liberating. So there's the inner aspect of living the Eightfold Path, and then the outer aspect. Okay, sort of what I call where the Dharma hits the dirt, you know, where the wheel touches the world. Okay, and so as I go through again each aspect of the Eightfold Path, then that will become a little more evident. So three of the eight spokes on the wheel are what are called the meditative qualities. Okay, and that's the cultivation of the ability for the mind to engage in tranquil, sustained attention. Tranquil, focused, sustained attention. It's called samadhi, or concentration sometimes. Not a great translation, actually, because it denotes a certain tightness of mind, when in fact, samadhi is about relaxing the mind, allowing it to settle into its natural state. And there, in the cultivation of samadhi, there are ways to do it that actually lead to deeper awareness and greater calmness, and ways that don't. And it has to do with the nature of the effort that you put into it. So it's paying attention to the effort that we put toward allowing the mind to get calm and clear. And then when the mind gets calm and clear, the third meditative factor that becomes possible is mindfulness. Being able to see clearly everything that's going on, including especially what's going on in the mind. Okay. Cultivating those meditative qualities of skillful effort, of tranquil, focused, sustained attention, and of mindfulness prepares the mind for recognizing or realizing the next two spokes of the wheel, which are called the wisdom factors. And that is wise understanding, okay, which is to say insight into all the causes and conditions that go into making everything be, okay, including all the causes and conditions that went into making us who we are right up to this very moment. All the beneficial ones, all the harmful ones, all the difficult ones, all the liberating ones. Okay. So it's why we call it insight meditation. When the mind gets that calm and clear and capable of really looking deeply into the mind to see what's going on, we can learn a great deal about why we are who we are, okay, right up until this moment in time. The other wisdom factor is usually described as or understood as wise intention. Okay. So based on all that we know already about who we are up to this moment, wise intention is about who we're going to be in the next moment. It's the ability to perceive the intentions that rise in the mind before we speak, before we act. Okay. And then cumulatively, how we make our way in the world, the patterns of our lives. And those last three aspects, okay, speech, action, and way of life, are the last three aspects of the Eightfold Path. Okay. In Buddhist temples throughout Asia, and many here in the West as well, you'll see three things on the altar. One is incense. And that is reflective of the meditative factors, the concentrating of the mind. Another is candles, and that is the representation of wisdom, the wisdom factors. Okay. And then on most altars, you'll also see flowers or maybe some fruit or something like that. And that represents the manifestation in the world of the meditative factors and the wisdom factors. So where either the perpetuation of this or the cessation of suffering happens in the Eightfold Path is in this interface between intention and action, between intention and speech. Because if we can catch in the mind unskillful intentions before we act on them, before we speak in an unskillful way, then that's the point at which we can begin to free ourselves from suffering and also cease inflicting it on others. That's why the mindfulness, the observation, the ability to see clearly what's going on in the mind moment to moment is so important. Because when we can see unwholesome intentions arise, okay, and have enough insight and discipline to not act on them, we don't create more suffering. We don't create more suffering for ourselves or for others. And in the opening lines of the Dhammapada, we become what we think. All that we are arises with our thoughts. With our thoughts, we create the world. Another way you can understand that teaching is that, let's just substitute the word intention. We become what we intend to become. All that we are arises with our intentions. With our intentions, we create the world. Speak or act with unwholesome intention, and sorrow shall follow you as surely as the wheels on the cart follow the oxen who draw it. We become what we think. We become what we intend to become. All that we are arises with our intentions. With our intentions, we create the world. Speak or act with wholesome intention, and joy shall follow you as your shadow, unswerving. In other words, as you can tell from the Buddha's words, intention is kind of a big deal. It's the little, you know, if you look at, you know, a model of one of these great super tankers, right, you know, giant ship, you know, this huge thing moving through the water, and then only about 2% of the length of it is the rudder. Okay. But you can think of that rudder as intention. You know, just move that little rudder just a few degrees one way or another, and you send the whole shebang off in the one direction or another. And so it's so important that we do everything we can to learn to observe what our intentions are. So the Buddha gave this teaching for the monastics in this monastic sangha about a great long list of behavioral rules that one could follow if you're trying to do everything possible to avoid causing harm to self or others. And all that's in one of the texts of the Pali Canon called the Vinaya. Happily, for those of us who are not monastics, it whittled 230 or so rules down to just 5. And so what I want to do in this series is to look together at what these 5 precepts are. Okay. When you go on a meditation retreat, one of the things that you do at the beginning of the retreat, you take refuge in the Buddha and the Dharma and the Sangha, and then there are these 5 precepts that we recite as well. Those precepts are the means by which we co-create spiritual community in Buddhism. Okay. So there are sort of vows that we take one to another, assurances that we give to each other as to how we will seek to live together, okay, in a way that makes possible. So we kind of train each other in that way and how to live the Buddha's teaching in terms of speech and action and way of life. So in sharing these, one of the great challenges of teaching these precepts, or what we call the lay precepts, is that because of the religious tradition that most of us were raised in, if we were raised in one, there's a great deal of emphasis not only on an external authority figure, but one who you owe a duty of good behavior toward. One who has instructed you on how to be, and there are rules that you should follow, and if you don't follow them, then you will be cast into the outer darkness, right? And you will be unfit to be part of the gang. And that can lead to a lot of self-doubt, and so it led to a lot of people with what were seen to be the harsh rules of thou shalt and thou shalt not to just walk away from the tradition. And so one of the things that's really important in sharing these precepts is to understand them to be different. They are not like the Ten Commandments, right? It's much more useful if we can understand them as simply part of the Buddha's teaching on suffering and the end of suffering. Okay. Dukkha and the cessation of dukkha. More kind of like natural history lessons, you know, or laws of thermodynamics, right? It's basically just statements of cause and effect. If you want to live a life that is reflective of the values in the Buddha's teachings, number one, the first of these 5 precepts, is nonviolence. So, not in the way it's usually given, as to not kill living beings. In the old days, when the Buddha gave that teaching, only members of the animal kingdom were thought to be sentient beings. Okay, and so the question is often asked, you know, was the Buddha a vegetarian? You know, and were the members of his monastic sanghas vegetarian? And the answer is no. What would happen when they would go out in the morning on their alms rounds is that the community would share of what they had. And that would be what the monks and nuns would subsist on. So whatever it was that folks in the community were eating, that's what they ate too. And it was sort of thought to be kind of reflective of the degree to which, you know, the communities that were supporting them, kind of how they felt about their teachings and whatnot as to what they gave them to eat, you know. One of my own teachers, Jack Kornfield, spoke about when he was living for several years in Thailand as a monastic at the center that was headed by Ajahn Chah, Thai Forest Meditation Master. He would go down alms rounds into the community there in rural southeastern Thailand, and come back sometimes with some fried insects and a little bit of monkey meat. And he remarked to one of the other monks, they must not have such a high view of the Dharma around here right now. And the monk told him, oh no, many of these people have not eaten meat in weeks. They've given you the very best that they have. So what the Buddha did say is that if you're going to be visiting a home or a community, ask that nothing be killed in order to feed you. So insofar as the karmic link was concerned, then if they had if they have an opportunity for choice in the matter in terms of what's going to be prepared, then they would prefer it to be vegetarian. Otherwise, it's to simply eat that which is offered. I was at the Thai Wat here a few years ago for a ceremony, a relic ceremony, and the monastics out there had invited me on behalf of our Sangha to come a couple of times and say a few words or whatever, and then was invited for this meal, this Sunday meal, and one of the monks there said, oh, you must try my specialty. It's a sardine salad. And it was taking that which is given. I actually kind of like it. Happily, I like sardines. But so it also varies from culture to culture in terms of how these things are held. Okay, that which the culture needs to subsist on is what you subsist on. And a lot of research lately in the consciousness of plants, for instance, it turns out they're just as sentient as animals, right? And essentially, life feeds on life. The only wisdom tradition that really tries to work with that particular situation is the Jains in India, and they eat only foods that are generated by plants that don't have to be killed. So they eat a lot of fruits and nuts. Okay. One of the reasons cattle are holy in India is because they give milk. And so that's why they don't generally like to see them killed, because then they're not able to produce food for others. So anyway, this teaching about nonviolence and not killing is something we can go into a little bit greater detail another time. Second precept, not taking that which is not given. Obviously, not stealing, not taking things that belong to other people. All of us who've had things stolen from us know it's kind of a bummer, right? It's partly because you miss your possession and partly because you realize you live in a society where people steal things from each other. Not good. But there are other ways to think about it too, having to do with consumerism, for instance. How much more do we take than we need in order to make our way in the world? Okay. Another really worthy area of investigation for us to look at. Third precept simply says not to engage in sexual misconduct. Not to use one's sexual energy in a way that causes harm to oneself or another. Again, we'll explore that further down the road. In the lay precepts, it says absolutely nothing about either sexual orientation or gender identity in Theravada Buddhism. It's just not in the map, Celibacy is what's called for monastics, but for laity, it's simply, not engaging in sexual misconduct. Fourth precept is to not lie, not misrepresent, not say something that you either know not to be true or that you suspect may be a little off the mark, but you say it for some reason or another anyway. When we were just finishing our seminary program, in 2000 in the Spirit Rock Meditation Center. The teacher that visited us for our final session, kind of a little, you know, going away chat, was Joseph Goldstein. He's also, you know, I've had the good fortune of him being a teaching mentor for me. And I asked him a question just as we were coming to an end. I said, you know, we've been studying and practicing the Dharma for years and years in this training program. If we've learned anything, it's the absolute importance of telling each other the truth. You know, of just being as honest and forthright as we can about where we're coming from, what's going on. And yet, I keep noticing, as some of us have as well, that when we're talking about the Dharma or doing teachings, or especially when we're being interviewed by one of our own teachers, that there is this inevitable tendency to want to try to come across as being a little more realized or a little wiser than we actually think we are. And he said, you know, it's just what the mind does. It's just something else to keep, you know, an eye on. And to remain mindful of as you go forth to teach. Kind of a lighthearted, easy answer. And then he said, and the entire future of the Dharma in the West depends on it. Which is to say, respect for the truth, you know. That's one of the translations of the word Dharma. You know, just to be as honest and open as we can. A few years later, I went on sabbatical from university teaching and from Dharma teaching for about 6 months. I did a long retreat at the Forest Refuge back east, and at a time when he happened to be the teacher in residence. And so I told him in my exit interview that I had really had a lot of opportunity to reflect on my teaching, and really wanted to really have as much integrity and truthfulness as I could bring to bear in the process. And I said, I don't think I really want to teach anymore until I really find that I can actually really do it from a place of not-self. And he said, you know, if everyone had that attitude, there wouldn't be very much Dharma getting taught. He said, so what you're basically telling me is you don't plan to teach the Dharma until you reach the fourth stage of enlightenment, right? Because the last thing of the fetters, the last one to be let go of, is the notion of self, right? There are all these other kind of loosenings of these things that bind one to, involuntarily actually, to the states of being that perpetuate suffering. And the last one to let go of, the last one for the mind to let go of, is the notion of self. In fact, the final thought that often occurs when somebody is entering, you know, nearing or coming upon self-liberation is, ah, I am becoming enlightened. The final one to be let go of. So, right, this notion that somehow, you know, we can go, you know, put on, you know, a kind of a little kind of virtual uniform of, you know, perfect bodhisattvahood, you know, it doesn't really work like that, you know. The cloak is the truth, right? So just being as honest as we can, right? And then the final one is got to do with keeping the mind clear so the mind can be continuously mindful. Which is to say, not ingesting anything that prohibits mindfulness. So, not ingesting alcohol, and not ingesting recreational drugs that have the effect of dulling or eliminating the possibility of mindfulness. And again, what the Buddha is saying is not thou shalt not. He said, if you don't keep this precept, observe what happens. Look what happens in terms of your speech. Look what happens in terms of your behavior. Look what happens in terms of how you treat other people. Okay. When you are and are not obeying that precept. Same with truth-telling. Look what happens when you do and when you don't. Same with sexual misconduct. Or behaving with sexual integrity is the more positive way to put it, right? What happens when you do? What happens when you don't? What happens when you take more than you need? All right, when you get, when greedy mind takes over. Okay. What happens when it's at work? What happens when it doesn't? When aversion arises in the mind and causes you to speak or act in ways that do harm. Okay. What happens when you do that, and what happens when you don't do that? That's all he invites us to do. So, that's the general schema. I'd like to invite any questions or comments anyone has, and then we can maybe turn our attention to, you know, how to practice these things when we're here together. So, any questions about anything I've touched on so far? Yes, please.
I just want to know how you got from the resolution to keep jumping from a place of not-self to wherever you are today.
What Joseph was trying to get at, I think, when he made that comment, you know, was that, and he knows me well, so he really just kind of nailed it, you know, and it has to do with this sense of perfectionism, right? And whether in the teaching realm or just trying to embody the Dharma in daily life, the way the mind tends to do it, just like I did, you know, on that retreat, is we get some notion of what it means to be a good yogi, or what it means to be a good bodhisattva, you know. So we get this kind of an ideal notion of how we ought to be, and then we try to live up to that ideal. And for most of us, it's the way we were taught from when we were children on up, especially if we were raised in a sort of a dualistic religious tradition. It was that you aspire to a certain image of how you ought to be. Okay. And basically, what that is a construct of a discursive mind. You get some image of what it means to be holy or whatever, right? And you try to allow that to be your lodestar, you know, the North Star. And what I found when I really had a hard look at, and I think probably most of us do, if you really look at this sense of, or this mental activity of incessant perfectionism, it's a function of the ego. It's the discursive mind coming up with some idea of what it means to be holy, or what it means to walk in the path of the Buddha. Okay. And in the alternative, it's not to say that we don't want to live with integrity, that we don't want to live in a way that honors those around us, that we don't want to live in a way that honors who we are. It's how we go about doing it. And the more skillful way, in my experience, of going about that, it's just what I was talking about earlier. Just looking at the interface between intention and action, between intention and speech. And so I was kind of calling myself out a little while ago, you know. And I think whether it's me teaching the Dharma or you sharing your knowledge of the Dharma with a friend or just reflecting on it yourself, you know, from what position are you speaking? Right. One of the things that came up a lot in our training program was this notion of what would be called getting out of the way of the Dharma, which is to say, it's this, it's these beautiful truths that you kind of want to be shared, but you don't want to pretend like you don't have a personality, that you're not working through this stuff just like everybody else is, but you don't also don't want to become all about you. And I think that it's finding that balance point, you know, really trying to be as open as we can about where our working edge is, who we are and whatnot, but at the same time, letting go of the ideal. And because what that does is sets us up for a lot of striving, you know, and one of the things that really bummed me out when I was a kid in school was that I'd always do well in these aptitude tests, you know, and I did well in subjects that I liked, and I didn't do so well in the ones I didn't like. And my counselors, when they would meet with my parents, you know, the rap on me was not living up to his potential. You know, what a bummer, you know. And so, you know, I think my dad was a PhD, you know, he was a faculty member in the pharmacy school, and I think I got lousy grades in science just to spite him, you know. I wasn't especially good at it anyway, but I mean, I could have worked harder, but I didn't, you know, I did the things I'd like to do. And so all the way through school and whatnot, it was this notion of not living up to potential, right? And so I, you know, obviously carried that forward into the Dharma as well, and I imagine a lot of us also have. So it comes back to being just really, I don't know, accepting, you know, of who we are. And instead of being driven by an image of who we ought to be that we're not, to use a different guidance system altogether. One that really comes from like what Kevin's going to be talking about next week, you know. To be guided not by an egoistic notion of what it means to be, you know, holy or what it means to be realized in the Buddha tradition, but to be guided by a sense of self-compassion, you know, and the sure and certain knowledge that we will blow it, that we will goof up, you know, we will screw up when it comes to speech and action and whatnot, and to be ready to forgive ourselves and to ask forgiveness of others when we do it, okay? To remember the state of deep equanimity that is within each of us when we can allow it to be kind to ourselves and others, you know, just to do those things, just to seek to live that way when we can, has the effect of achieving the objective. It's moment-to-moment realization. You know, it's moment-to-moment incremental transformation to a way of life that is guided by those qualities of heart-mind rather than a notion of who we want to be. Very long answer to a short, simple question. Please.
Yeah, I have a lot of perfectionism in me, and I try to remember what someone said, perfect is the enemy of good. Uh-huh. And I think I try and think of, you know, my ideals, and I'm not at my ideals, but that's sort of the how do I want to see it? That's the fuel. That gap provides the fuel to, you know, inspire me to go towards my ideals. You know, mm-hmm. You know, maybe what you said, working edge. You know.
Right.
And sort of keeping it, you know, in balance and not going to the extreme and the perfectionist thing.
Yeah. Know. Yeah. In the teachings of the Dzogchen teachings and the Vajrayana, the Tibetan tradition, you know, there's this phrase, resting in one's own natural perfection. What's meant by that is that we're already perfect. We just haven't realized it yet. And not having awakened to our own perfection, we strive for perfection. And basically it's already there. We can just sort of recognize it and relax into it. Other questions or comments? Please.
I'm getting better and better at giving up some of the perfection programming I have for myself, but I'm always projecting it on my wife.
Say more what you mean by that.
Pardon?
Say more what you mean by
that. Well, she has to do the dishwasher the way it's supposed to be done.
Oh, I see. All right. Yeah, I think I get it right. So I'm perfect. It's everyone else that's the problem. Yeah. Okay.
She has to turn out the lights and close the doors.
Well, it sounds like you're getting better at recognizing what the mind is up to, which I'd say is an important step in the right direction.
Well, she reminds me of it.
Yes, right. Yeah, whenever I go off the deep end, my wife sometimes says, "Nice going, Mr. Dharma." Nothing like that to keep you honest, man. So the realm of wise, skillful speech. One of the neat things about Sangha is that we have a chance to practice this stuff together. We have a chance to recognize when we are engaging in wise or skillful speech and when we're not. And so if we can really practice doing that while we're with each other, then it makes it easier for us to recognize when we are and are not doing it out in the wider world. Okay. So the Buddha, over the course of his teachings, came up with this sort of a checklist for what constitutes a wise or skillful speech and what doesn't. So in this handout, you can see, rather than just having kind of be binary, the reason I drew this sketch the way I did is because what we're actually looking at, I think, is a range of different qualities. Okay. And one aspect of wise or skillful speech is the intention underlying it. Is it a beneficial or unskillful intention? It's like it says in the Dhammapada. Okay. What is the intention underlying the speech? Is it beneficially intended, or is it maliciously intended? Or is it someplace in between? Second, is it useful? Is it constructive? Does it have a positive purpose? Or is it just idle gossip, saying stuff about people who aren't around, right? Buddha said idle gossip is, you know, it's not harmless. There are all kinds of things that come up when one is speaking mindlessly about, you know, matters or people or whatever. It goes around and can do a great deal of harm. Is it truthful? Or is it untruthful? Is it timely or untimely? Your speech can be beneficially intended, it can be useful, it can be the truth, but it may not be the time to say it, right? So knowing when it's useful to say something. What that's really getting at in a significant way, I think, is the art of mindful listening. If you're more intent on saying what you have to say than you are noting where in the flow of conversation it might best be said, or if it needs to be said at all, that's an art form. That's something that really needs to be paid attention to. And then finally, it can be beneficially intended and useful and truthful and timely, but harsh, right? So that still winds up having a pretty negative effect, even if all the other aspects are true. In other words, this practice of trying to be mindful with our speech is doing everything we can to make sure that our speech meets each of these five criteria at some threshold level. not perfection necessarily, but at least to be mindful of these different aspects of speech before we speak. So if you're finding yourself in especially an animated conversation, okay, it's really easy for one or more of these to go flying right out the window, maybe almost all of them, right? But if you can train yourself gradually to run this checklist before engaging the mouth, okay, it makes it much less likely that your speech is going to have a harmful effect. It may also mean that you don't talk as much, or that you speak more slowly when you do, okay? Because I think we all have habits when it comes to, you know, how we make our points in the world and how we don't, some of which may serve us well at times, others that are very unconscious, you know, that are very automatic, and that sometimes can do considerable harm without us having a clue that that's what's going on. So any thoughts about your work with right speech or with, you know, why you're skillful speech or not? Yeah. Yes, please.
I think we all want to be a friend. So if someone was given a talk and, well, we're sort of not so positive about it or neutral, our tendency is to make it more positive. I think that a lot of speech is that way, that it's trying to maintain relationships rather than giving an honest appraisal.
Yes. Yes. Exactly.
Appreciate your comments.
Yeah. How to be kindly, critically truthful. That's, you know, this stuff is an art form. There is absolutely no two ways about it. And in Sangha, you know, when there's a divergence of views, you know, Gil Fronsdiel told me one time, you know, he has a Sangha in Redwood City in the San Francisco Bay Area near Silicon Valley. Very robust, lively Sangha. And he said that just like anybody else, there are people that he kind of likes naturally and people he doesn't particularly like. But he said that's utterly irrelevant to what it means for us to be together in Sangha, you know, because we owe each other the respect of these aspects of speech. Okay. And so if there are things going on in the song that don't feel right, for instance, you're right, there can be a tendency just to bury one's feelings or pull back a little bit or not speak up because of fear of being ostracized or not thought well of, you know. So expressing divergent points of view can be really important, actually, and it can help actually raise the group consciousness a little bit. But if we can listen creatively to points of view that we may not agree with, okay, there's a certain group wisdom that can come out of doing that. You know, if we're able to listen in a non-offensive way to what's coming out, then maybe we can hear something that we couldn't have heard before. Whereas if the speech is harsh, then it tends to shut down the listener, tend to kind of pull back. And so part of the art form here is there a way to express a divergent point of view that does not cause that defensive reaction, you know? In other words, to the extent possible, seek to be kind even while you're being critical. In fact, it's an absolute necessity if it's going to be effective speech. Okay. Because otherwise, it can have quite a destructive effect. You know, the Quarrel at Kasambi is a famous discourse where there was a monastic sangha, and it was split right down the middle, and there were two charismatic leaders, and one group lined up behind one, and the other group lined up behind the other, and they were going at hammer and tongs all the time. And they were both saying very derogatory things about the other side and the other side's teacher and whatnot. And it wound up causing the sangha to collapse. And part of the reason is because these two leaders couldn't speak to each other skillfully. They were unable to express divergent views with respect to the other view. If they had been able to model that behavior differently, then the sangha probably wouldn't have fallen apart. But they were both so wrapped up in the power of their own leadership role that it wound up destroying the sangha. And because of the respect for their seniority, no one else spoke up against them, right? And so one of the things that in Gil Fronsdale's teachings about sangha, he says that originally, as it was conceived, it was a radically democratic gathering, right? Because everyone had the common intention of trying to really live the Buddha's teachings. And when they felt like somebody else wasn't, even if it was somebody like in a teaching role, then they would try to find some kind way to point that out. You know, one of the things when we went forth to start teaching is that one of the final instructions we got is you all really need to stay in touch with each other, which is to say those of us who were just winding it up. The teachers that tend to get in the most trouble down the road are the ones that don't have somebody else who can say, oh, what you got going there? Maybe we can reflect a little on, you know, what you just did or what you said or whatever. So we kind of just sort of keep an eye on each other for our own good. And so at Insight Meditation Center in Barrie, at the Spirit Rock Meditation Center, there are teachers' councils, right? And that's one of the things they do when they meet, is to make sure that they kind of take care of each other in that way. And it's something that we can do too as a sangha. We can take care of each other by being mindful of how we speak and how we listen, how we treat each other. Because what happens is we get more and more sensitized to when we're really treating each other with respect and when maybe we're not. And the better we get at it here, the better we get at it going forth into the world. You know, most of us have a sense that some people around us are deserving of respect and others aren't. And the Buddha said, see if you can get beyond that. What he said was, see yourself in others. Not a little different from what Jesus of Nazareth said, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. See yourself in others, he said. That person is no different from you, that person is you in some way, shape, or form. He says, see yourself in others, whom then can you harm? That's a real intimacy, isn't it? To have this, you know, we talk about the relative and the absolute ways of seeing the world. You know, in the relative world, we carry our own little bag of skin and a certain color, and we have, you know, a certain gender and all that. But at other levels, that become more apparent the longer we do this practice, the more we see that our how we are alike is so extraordinarily more important and more vast than how we're different. Okay, well, on the relative level, we've gone and burned through another two perfectly good hours. Let's take our sitting posture again, if you could, just for a moment. Physical suffering and mental affliction. May we treat ourselves and each other with patience and kindness and open-heartedness and compassion. May we be happy. May we be peaceful. And may we self-liberate. Have a safe journey home, everybody.